Okay. A reminder what we're doing here. We're looking at the context of the New Testament situation after the intertestamental period. And what we've been doing the last few weeks is covering the political situation. So we've looked at the rule of Rome, and then last week we looked at the house of Herod and all of the Herods that we find in the New Testament. So we finished the political situation, and now we're turning to the cultural situation at the time of the New Testament. And that's, I guess it's on the back of your handout. That'll take us to the rest of this handout. So we've talked a lot about Hellenization throughout the course, and a reminder about what that is. It's bringing Greek culture into the Eastern cultures from the West, from Greece. And we've seen in some of our studies so far the kind of impact that Hellenization had on the Eastern cultures. Some examples of that are politics, athletics, the literature of Greece came in, the Greek language, of course, became very prominent, Greek dress, philosophy, and architecture. All of those things are different aspects of the culture that the Greeks influenced. And that influence was felt in the area of Palestine as well. As you might expect, the Greek culture coming into Palestine, into the nation of Israel, provided a lot of challenges for Jews and how to react to that. And we've reviewed earlier some of the different ways that the Jews responded to that, and I kind of highlighted three different possibilities there, one of them being that some of the Jews just accepted it and embraced it and promoted the adoption of Greek culture. Others were very resistant to it and said we shouldn't adopt any of it. And then there were those in the middle who tried to synthesize the Greek ways with the Jewish traditions. And so we kind of looked at those three different responses. The Greek culture that we find in the time of Jesus, it's all in the background in the New Testament. It's sort of like the rule of Rome. It's kind of just everywhere in the New Testament. It's pervasively lying underneath everything that we read in the New Testament. The Greek culture is kind of that way too. You might not find that many specific examples or references to it, but it's the air that they were breathing during the New Testament era. There are a few examples that we can point to from the New Testament. One thing that you may not have thought about before is that most of the apostles, came from the region of Galilee. Remember Jesus calling the apostles on the Sea of Galilee, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, at least the fishermen. The area of Galilee was an area that was heavily influenced by Greek culture. If you think about the map, just the geography, that would have been the place where the ways of the West came through Galilee into Palestine. And so it was an area of heavy migration of Greeks from the West to the East. And the Herods, we saw last week how many of the Herods built cities and things like that to honor Caesar. We looked at Caesarea Philippi, Tiberias is another town. All of those towns are towns in that region of Galilee. So there was a lot of Greek architecture and Greek construction projects that took place in that area. So the point there is that even the apostles, the 12 apostles, or at least 11 of them, would have been very familiar with Greek culture and the Greek ways. Then when we get further into the New Testament, and particularly in the book of Acts, we start to see some examples of that, where we have, for instance, the passage in Acts chapter 6, where we had the dispute, if you remember, the dispute between the Grecian and the Hebrew Jews. The Hebrew Jews were the ones that were getting all of the benevolence, and the Greek Jews were being neglected. And that then led to the appointment of what's typically called the first deacons in the church. And if you notice, if you read that passage, then many of the deacons had Greek names. So they would have been the Grecian Jews in order to serve the Grecian Jews. Also, later in the book of Acts, in chapter 9, we see that Paul was disputing with Grecian Jews. That's the actual term that's used. So you can see the Greek influence there, even among the Jews. The Greek culture had made inroads even into Judaism. The other thing that we looked at a long time ago was all of the conflicts within the priesthood. If you remember all of those conflicts that we saw, a lot of that was due to this tension between the ones that wanted to follow the ways of the Greeks and the ones that didn't want to follow the ways of the Greeks. So that led to the conflicts in the priesthood, and ultimately it led to the Maccabean Revolt, It also contributed significantly to the formation of the different Jewish groups or Jewish sects that we're going to look at maybe starting next week. So Hellenization had a big, powerful impact on Jewish culture in the New Testament era. And I've skipped over that really quickly because we've talked a lot about it previously. But let's look at another thing that was influencing the culture of the time, and that is the fact that the Jews were dispersed throughout the nations. So that's called the dispersion. It refers to the fact that the Jews were dispersed to many other nations, and it comes from the Greek term diaspora. You've probably heard that term too. Diaspora means dispersed peoples, and that's often applied to the Jews, that they're diaspora, because they're scattered throughout the nations. There's many different reasons why the Jews were dispersed. What are maybe two obvious reasons that the Jews were dispersed that you can think of? Try to ask an actual question here. Get your mind going. Persecution, right? Yep, exactly. Exile, I heard somebody say exile back there. Same thing. Right, so exile is one of the obvious reasons why the Jews were dispersed. There were two different groups that were exiled. The first was the Northern Kingdom. So the Northern Kingdom was exiled first. They were deported. The Jews in the Northern Kingdom, you remember, were actually deported by the Northern Kingdom of Assyria. This was around 722 BC. There's a couple very explicit passages in 2 Kings chapter 17 that tell us this. This is 2 Kings 17:6. It says, "In the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala, in Gozan, on the Habor River, and in the towns of the Medes." So he grabbed people from the northern kingdom, took them back towards Assyria, and also settled them further to the east in the lands of the Medes. 2 Kings 17:23 says this, "So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there." So that's an important point too, that, well, at least at the time of the writing, they were still in exile. And little is known for certain of what became of the northern exiles, and that thus we have the, sometimes you hear, the lost 10 tribes of Israel. They're lost because they were exiled into the northern and eastern kingdoms, and that's pretty much the last we hear of them as an organized group. Remember, the people that returned to the land were not the northern tribes, they were the exiles to Babylon. And that doesn't exclude necessarily that some of the other Jews could have returned as well, but we don't really read much about that. Of course, the next major reason for dispersion was the next exile, which happened under the Babylonians. The exile of Judah by Babylon happened in three phases, you probably know. 605 BC, then another one in 597 BC, and then the final one in 586 BC. Which was when Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple was destroyed. So that was the remainder of the Jews that were in the land were exiled then by the Babylonians. That, of course, is a major reason why the Jews are dispersed, at least in the north and in the east. But there were other reasons for the dispersion, one of them being political immigration. We've heard many times in this class how there were many Jews in Egypt, and many Jews relocated to Egypt, especially to Alexandria. And we know that Antiochus III, one of the Ptolemy rulers in Egypt, actually enlisted Jews in his armies and then relocated them to Lydia and Phrygia, so up into Galatia, up into the area south of Galatia. So political immigration was another reason that the Jews dispersed. And then there were just simply family immigrations were happening as well. Jews migrated throughout the nations. We know that they went to Asia Minor. We know that they went to Rome. And there were incentives to colonize by the Romans, to move different people into different colonies. A lot of times, ex-Roman military rulers were given territory intending to colonize it. So there were areas that were colonized under the Roman Empire. And there were incentives for people to come and build those colonies. Economical reasons is another reason why people would migrate. And even just the natural inclination due to the growing population in a small area, people would want to expand. So there are a lot of different causes of dispersion, but the fact is in the New Testament, when we read the New Testament, the Jews are pervasively expanded throughout all of the nations. They're not just in the nation of Israel anymore. Now, when we talk about the dispersion of the Jews, we naturally think about the temple, because the temple was the one thing that kept them united in Jerusalem. And I think we mentioned a few weeks ago that the Jewish people, more than any other nation, were focused on a location, because that location is where God had his throne, in the temple. Think about it, how that's different from all of the other religions of the world. That's very different. The gods of the nations were not necessarily localized in a specific location. They could be moved with the people. If the people moved, they would take their gods with them. Sometimes, and we learn this in the Old Testament as well, sometimes when people would come to a new area, they would adopt the gods of that area. So there was a lot of syncretism, a lot of flexibility in what gods they would worship. Sometimes the local gods were the ones that were seen to have power, you know, for fertility, for crops growing, for rain. And so when you move to a new land, you would want to adopt the customs and worship those gods rather than the ones of the one where you came from, because they were very localized in their authority. So the Jewish religion was quite different from that. The God of the Israelites, of course, was seen as being enthroned in the temple in Jerusalem in a single place. He was also, of course, viewed as having authority over all of the nations, because he's the only true God, and they recognized that. So the Jewish center of religion and identity was their one God, the monotheism of the true God, enthroned in the temple of Jerusalem. Along those lines, I'm often reminded of the lament in Psalm 137 when the Jews were exiled. It doesn't specifically mention the temple we've been talking about, but if you remember that psalm, I'll turn to it here and read a few verses from it. This is from the exiles in Babylon. So this is Psalm 137. You just capture the feeling and the despair at being exiled, at being away from Jerusalem. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. So that captures the feeling that the exiles had when they were away from Jerusalem, because that's where the Lord was enthroned. Now, we've seen that the temple was actually rebuilt. The temple was rebuilt, and temple worship was reestablished after Cyrus had the exiles return. The worship was reestablished in 516 BC, and that's why this period of history is sometimes called the second period of Jewish history, or sometimes you hear the phrase Second Temple Judaism. That's what that is referring to, the fact that there's a second temple that's been built now. And Second Temple Judaism is the type of form that the religion took after the rebuilding of the temple. But after 70 years without a temple, many Jews had learned to live without the temple. Just think about, what is that? That's like two generations. 70 years is kind of like two generations of people. Think about what happened in the wilderness in 40 years. Remember what happened with the new generation? They didn't know the God of their fathers after just one generation. So you can imagine what it would have been like being in exile for, you know, maybe two, three generations of people who hadn't even experienced the temple worship. So many Jews had learned to live without it. The other factor is that many Jews never returned to the land of Israel. We have numbers of how many returned in some of the books, like in Nehemiah, but many never returned. Many were content to stay where they were. We know, for instance, well, at least we believe Daniel didn't return with the exiles that did return. Many would go ahead and make the pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the feasts when they were able to. We have an example of that at Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, when many of the Jews had converged on Jerusalem. We also see that in the New Testament, at many of the feast times when Jesus would go up to Jerusalem, there would be people from many nations there celebrating the various harvest feasts, weeks or harvest, the Passover, the three major feasts where the Jewish males were required to go up to Jerusalem to the temple. So many would come back for those, but they wouldn't permanently relocate back to the land of Israel. Remember also, in terms of the temple worship, that a second temple had been established in Egypt as well. We talked about that earlier, to serve the Jewish population there. At the time of Jesus, that temple was still in operation. So that's another consideration. And then with respect to the temple itself, it was finally destroyed, of course, in AD 70 by the Romans. And that has never been rebuilt after that. So the dispersion of the Jews is sort of a permanent event, a permanent state of affairs at this point in time. There are a number of witnesses to the fact that the Jews are dispersed throughout the nations. We have New Testament references that we'll look at. But we also have secular references to the dispersion of the Jews throughout the nations. There's a historian by the name of Strabo who in 85 BC, but by the time of 85 BC, he says this: "Now these Jews are already gotten into all cities, and it is hard to find a place in the habitable earth that hath not admitted this tribe of men and is not possessed by them." So that's a secular historian referring to the dispersion of the Jews. Josephus says, "There is not a people in the world which does not contain a portion of our race." And then we have a lot of evidence of Jews being in Rome. The Jews in Rome, there's evidence that they were there as early as 139 BC. So that's, well before the time of Christ. In the time of Caesar Augustus, there was a considerable Jewish population in Rome. Josephus speaks of more than 8,000 Jews being in Rome after the death of Herod the Great. So that's around the time of the birth of Christ. There would have been, possibly up to 8,000 Jews in Rome. And then some historians have estimated that at the beginning of the Christian era, there were as many as 60,000 Jews in Rome and the area around Rome. So there was a significant Jewish population in Rome. Now, in the New Testament, we have many references to the fact that the Jews are dispersed throughout the nations. I'll just turn to a couple of these, give you a few examples. In John chapter 7, so this is in the Gospel of John now, the Jews are scattered among the Greeks here. This is John chapter 7, starting at verse 33. Jesus said, "I am with you for only a short time, and then I go to the one who sent me. You will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come." The Jews said to one another, "Where does this man intend to go that we cannot find him? Will he go where our people live, scattered among the Greeks, and teach the Greeks?" So you can see there that our people are scattered among the Greeks. Maybe Jesus is going to go elsewhere. And then, of course, in Acts chapter 2, which I mentioned a moment ago, we have the Pentecost event. And here there's people from all over the place. At the speaking of tongues, all the men from every nation were hearing the apostles speak in their own language. So in Acts chapter 2, verses 9, we have a list of some of these areas. I'll start in verse 8. It says, "Then how is it that each of us hears them in his own native language? Parthians, Medes, and Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues." So these would have been Jews that were coming for the Feast of Pentecost from all of these nations. And if you just think geographically of all those nations that I just listed, that's pretty much the entire Roman Empire. We have Jews from Egypt, all the way from the Medes and the Parthians, which is all the way to the east, and then all of Asia Minor in Rome. So that pretty much covers the entire Roman Empire of the time. So there were Jews scattered throughout the Roman Empire. And then some of the epistles are addressed to, or at least refer to, these people. James chapter 1, verse 1 says, "James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations." 1 Peter, verse 1. "Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia." So that's the area of Asia Minor. So some of the epistles are written to the dispersed Jews throughout the nations. The other evidence we have from the New Testament is, you remember that the Jews were expelled from Rome for a time. We're told about that in the book of Acts. That happened under Emperor Claudius. He expelled the Jews from Rome in AD 49, and we read about that in Acts chapter 18. And that's also attested by secular historians that the Jews were expelled from Rome. However, we know that that didn't last long, because by the time the Apostle Paul arrived there in Acts chapter 28, if you remember, the Jews met him. The brothers came and met him there. The Jews were already back and well established in Rome. So the expelling of the Jews from Rome was probably a relatively short thing. And then, of course, the other evidence that we have is the fact that there were synagogues in every city that Paul visited. That was one of his customs, was to go into the synagogue when he first went to a city. And the cities that he's traveling in now are the cities in Asia Minor and all the way to Rome. There were synagogues in every city. So that is more evidence that the Jews were dispersed throughout the nations. So what were the implications of the fact that the Jews were dispersed? Well, one of the implications is, and we know this is true of the world today, there's many more Jews throughout the nations than there actually are in the land of Israel. Of course, that's all magnified nowadays. But it's estimated that around, and we find this from the Bible, from the Old Testament, that around 50,000 people returned from the exile under Cyrus. Now, the estimates of those who remained in the East at later times was in the millions. So there were many more Jews, we believe, in the East than there were actually returning to the land. And then multiply that by the West as well. Most wealthy and influential Jews remained where they were. They had successful businesses. They were well provided for. And you think about the conditions of those Jews that returned from exile that we read about in Nehemiah, for example. And it was not an easy life. They were under fear of attack from various sides. You remember that many of them were living out in the villages, but then they rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem and there weren't enough people to actually populate the town. So they had to go ask people from the villages to come and sacrifice and move into the town of Jerusalem inside the walls. And then just building the walls was difficult as well. So it was a lot of hardship to move back to the land after the exile. So the Jews that remained in the nations had a unique challenge, right? They had to adapt to their new homes while still trying to maintain their unique identity as Jews and as monotheists in cultures where paganism was the rule of the day and in various forms of syncretism. And of course, we know that the dispersion of the Jews under God's providence was one of the major factors in the spread of the gospel in the New Testament. I just mentioned about Paul going into every synagogue. Wherever Paul went, there was a synagogue. And he went into the synagogues at pretty much in every city in Asia Minor. This, by the way, was also the source of much of his opposition was found when he went to the synagogues. And then he had to turn to the Greeks or the Gentiles after that. Pretty much all of his persecution was brought on by the Jews. But the nations were familiar with the monotheism of the Jews, with the God of the Bible. So that familiarity with monotheism had spread to the nations, and we know that many people had become God-fearers. Some people converted to Judaism, others didn't go all the way to convert to Judaism, but they became God-fearers, which meant that they worshiped the God of the Israelites. An example of that would be Cornelius in the book of Acts. So those people that were God-fearers were uniquely prepared to receive the gospel in a way that they wouldn't have been prepared if they were strictly pagan. So to sum up this whole idea, I've got a quote here from D.S. Russell. He says, the Septuagint, remember that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was in all of the lands of the Greeks at this time. The Septuagint, together with the vast network of synagogues in every part of the dispersion, and the many thousands of God-fearers not yet fully committed to the Jewish faith, prepared the way as nothing else could have done for the advancement of Christianity and the remarkable growth of the early Christian church. So we see in God's providence how he used the dispersion of the Jews as a sort of a predecessor to the spread of the gospel, a preparation for the spread of the gospel once that began to go out to all the nations. Okay, so that's another factor in the culture of the New Testament era is the dispersion. Any questions or comments on that before we go? Yes, go on. Dave. Oh, you mean the original exile. Why would they take them? Yeah, that's an excellent question. What was the advantage of taking people into exile? I think probably the major advantage was to destroy the nation so that it couldn't rise up again. And we know that that was the practice of the Assyrians, for example. They would destroy a nation, take the inhabitants away, you know, disperse them throughout their lands that they had control of, so you're dispersing their ability to reunite and cause more trouble for your empire. Then the Assyrians would actually bring other people from their other nations that they had conquered and resettle them into that place. Sort of, again, you know, you're just dispersing the trouble so that they can't ever rise again. The Babylonians, I think, had a similar kind of idea. The other consideration there is, you learn this especially in the three Babylonian exiles. Why were there three waves of exiles in Babylon? You know, you look at who they took first and then who they took last. The people that they took first were the most important people. The rich people, well, they would, of course, take the political rulers and the families of the monarchy. They would round all those people up and take them because think about them being well-bred. They can contribute to their society, but they are also exercising control over them so that they can't, again, have an uprising. The other people that they took right away were the artisans and the craftsmen and the people that could contribute to their society as, you know, good workers, people that could produce stuff. The people that they left behind were the poor people, and they would leave them there just to keep the land, you know, farming the land and things like that, so it didn't completely become overrun with briars and wild animals. So those are some of the considerations, I think, why it was in their best interest to actually take people into exile. You imagine it must have been a lot of work to take people into exile, right? You got thousands of people, and what are you going to do with them when they get there, right? So yeah, I don't know about all those logistics, but it would have been a very difficult proposition, I think. Yes, Robin. Right, so plunder is another reason that they would invade and take people into exile. The Babylonian one is so interesting because it happened in successive waves, but they did various levels of plunder each time. And it is interesting that when they did plunder, particularly the temple in Babylon, they could still go back 70 years later and bring all of those goods out of the treasury of Babylon. So they had probably a well-organized system of keeping the things from the... Imagine that they're doing that with all of the nations. They must have had some well-organized way of cataloging and storing the artifacts and the valuables that they would collect from the different nations. The Babylonian one is very interesting also because the Babylonians still retained control even after the first and the second. I mean, the reason that they were able to bring people was because they were sort of a vassal state of the Babylonians at that time. So they would leave some of the wealth there, but they would take some at each successive wave. And then, of course, when they came to actually destroy the city, then they would really plunder it and take everything of value and leave the rest of it behind. Yeah, Dave. The question is, under Hellenization, we mentioned a lot of cultural aspects of Hellenization. What about the religious aspect? And that's where those three responses really come into play, the acceptance of it, resistance of it, or trying to make a synthesis of it. The conservative Jews just completely rejected it, and like what you're saying, like this is incompatible with our religion. Others, who, you know, you would wonder if that maybe they weren't really true Jews at heart, embraced it. And this kind of goes along with the culture in some ways, like the athletic aspect of it. There's a lot of stuff written about the way that some Jews embraced the Greek games in Jerusalem. They built a gymnasium in Jerusalem. So then you had the mix of the Greeks competing and going to the gymnasium in the whole idea of being naked. And then the Jews were circumcised. Some Jews actually uncircumcised themselves so that they wouldn't be ashamed when they went into these Greek contests. That goes with the religion then, too. You can see that they're throwing off their religion when they do that as well. And then you had people like Philo is a good example in Egypt who tried to combine the ideas. I mean, he remained a Jewish monotheist as far as I know, but he tried to bring in Greek philosophy into the religious realm. I think he was arguing that Moses is the true philosopher, and you guys should all recognize that. But, you know, the fact is that he was syncretizing, making a synthesis of the Jewish religion with the pagan religions of the day. Frankly, those three responses are exactly the things that we deal with in our culture, right? When you look at it as Christians and what our response is to the secular culture or false religions or whatever, we have the same tendencies today. And there's different levels of accommodating to the culture. I'm on the side listening to another philosophy class. And one of the things that some of the early church fathers did was they were, of course, struggling with all of this. And some of them compromised a little bit. Origen is a really good example of that in the early church. He was definitely a Christian man. He was actually martyred for his faith eventually. But he was trying to wrap together the things that the Bible was teaching with what was happening, in his case, Greek philosophy and the philosophy of the day. And, you know, those guys didn't get it all right. They got some stuff wrong because they were trying to accommodate too much to the culture. So it's a constant battle that we face all the time is, you know, where are the lines that you can't cross when you're trying to live faithfully in a culture with different cultural ideas around you? So the early church fathers are really interesting because they're struggling with that, and you can tell they want to get it right. You know, we look back on it now and we can point out all the things wrong with Justin Martyr's theology and with Origen and everything. But at the time, those guys were doing their best to be faithful in a Greek culture when they're just being bombarded with all these ideas and stuff. And we have the benefit now of looking back, you know, standing on the shoulders of everyone and looking back at all those things that happened. And ultimately, those ideas and controversies led to the church councils. And then we, of course, have the benefit of having John Calvin and people like that that really brought everything together under the Word of God. So, anyways, that's a big, long digression on answering your question there. But the synthesis aspect is something that's very relevant to us today in the way that we approach the culture around us. Yes, Jen? I actually don't know the answer to that. Maybe, Pastor, I can put him on the spot. This is a tough question. Yeah, and the fact that once the sacrificial system was abolished is basically what you're asking. What do they do? You know, how can they be forgiven of their sins? And I don't know the answer to that either. I don't know what they do, but I do know that many Jews still pray towards Jerusalem, and, you know, when they go to the Wailing Wall, they're praying. And I think that there's a sense that there is a sacrifice needed, but how it actually works in practice, I don't know. You know, on the other hand, it's probably not that dissimilar from the exile, particularly after the temple was destroyed, that they're still trusting in God that he's going to deliver them somehow, and they just don't know how. You know, Yom Kippur is still a high holiday for Orthodox, the Jews that are still trying to be faithful to their religion, but there's no sacrifice, so how does that work? Yeah, it's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, that's an interesting point, and particularly since we're going through the book of Galatians, where it really is all about works. You know, that's what Paul is addressing there. Don't go back to the way of death, you know. Right. Yeah. Anyways, yeah, that's an excellent connection there to a religion of works.